You've worked hard for what you have, your money, your assets, your 401k, and home. Isn't it all worth protecting? Nearly one in four consumers have been a victim of identity theft. LifeLock Ultimate Plus helps protect your finances with up to $3 million in reimbursement. LifeLock alerts you to identity threats you might miss. And if your identity is stolen, your dedicated U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. Let LifeLock help protect what you've worked so hard for. Save 25% off your first year on LifeLock Ultimate Plus at LifeLock.com/aware. Terms apply.
Welcome to River Cafe Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
There's no such thing as a simple phone call with my beautiful friend Christiane Amanpour. Asking, as I did yesterday, where she's been, she answers, Ukraine. Asking where she's going, she says, Afghanistan. This is what it is like, having a fearless friend you love who puts herself in danger, reporting facts, holding people to account, and telling the truth from wherever she is and whoever she is talking to. Christiane goes on hiking trips, biking trips, retreats to her house in the Ile de Ré, flies to New York to see her son Darius. The food of Persia is her passion. Today I'm going to interview the most brilliant interviewer there is, and today I think I'm the fearless one. I ask everyone if they'd read a recipe from one of our cookbooks, and you said to me, actually what I'd like to do is talk about the box sets. Christiane, would you read the menu for the box set that you've chosen?
I will. So, of course, River Cafe focaccia, fabulous. Then a zucchini, the datterini tomatoes, broad beans, slow-cooked summer peas, never had those, were great. Cannellini beans and Italian spinach. It all sounds simple, but it's delicious. The other thing I really love is the spatchcock chicken. Again, it's deceptive because it looks like it's only for a few people, but it's for feeding the 5,000, basically. And the other thing I love is the pistachio cake.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Honestly, I'm originally Persian, Iranian, and English, and anything pistachio I love, and that is literally the best pistachio cake ever. It's so good. So, Ruthie, I chose a box set because, to be frank, I don't cook. And so to read a recipe sounded a little bit inauthentic for me, no matter how much I love eating your food at the River Cafe. And I have been incredibly spoiled during COVID and the last 2 years. Great friends, people like Laura and Eric Fellner, Laura Bailey and Eric Fellner, who come here a lot, spoiled me a lot with your box sets. And it was really something that was not just a luxury, but a massive comfort. And I'd gone through a bit of an illness last year, and they really sustained me, especially when people came to my house. You know, I was able to offer them things without myself having to cook.
I don't mind if you don't make, because whether you cook or you eat, and you do cook and you love food, and I think that you want to eat well. But what we need Christiane Amanpour for, and I need you for my friend, but the world needs you for the, as I said, the fearless. Do you like being called fearless? People say I'm fearless because I ski down mountains. Yeah. And I thought, no,
I think fearless, to be frank, I will give you my definition. I said once that I've lived most of my professional life in a state of repressed fear because you'd really be dumb if you said you weren't afraid of going to all these very terrifying places. Where you are in the crosshairs and you're also a target, not just randomly injured or killed like so many of us have been because we're deliberately targeted.
So they know.
They know.
You
go,
they know who you are and they know where you are and they know you're a journalist.
Yeah. And me and anybody else who's there with the words press on their fronts or on their vehicles. Yeah, and they do it because they don't want the truth out.
Yeah, and the they would be, give me some examples.
Well, let's say in the Bosnia War, it was the Bosnian Serb militants who were, you know, attacking the civilians in Sarajevo. That was their battle plan, much like what Putin has been doing in Ukraine. Mm.
Christiane, what was it like living under siege in Sarajevo?
Well, it became the longest siege in modern history. It was nearly 3 years long, which meant that the Bosnian Serbs, backed by Serbia, who were also backed then by Russia, were besieging a city of ordinary civilians in the most medieval way. And it meant that food wasn't coming in. It meant that, you know, they cut off heat, electricity, water, and they were bombarding. What then happened was that the United Nations got an agreement to have an airlift into the Sarajevo airport, and only those people, the UN was able to use it, and they would bring in pallets of humanitarian aid. So big pallets came in by military cargo planes, and they were your basics, what, flour, oil, beans, cans, stuff that was non-perishable that people could use. But the motif in terms of food was severe food poverty, the very, very first winter under siege. And it sounds like a cliche, and I didn't even believe it till I saw it. But literally people were foraging, honestly trying to get dandelion leaves and grasses and things like that that they might be able to boil up into something. Some of them may have had little vegetable gardens with lettuce or spinach or whatever it was. But there was no real protein. They could make bread because flour was coming in eventually by the UN. But it was basic. And, you know, I just remember living in the Holiday Inn with all the press there. I didn't realize until afterwards the managers had to pretty much bribe the besiegers and some of the UN peacekeeping forces who came in to get things like eggs and to get things like, I don't know, whatever. We didn't eat much.
We really didn't. What did you eat?
We'd not much. It was nothing very tasty, but I will never forget what an effort they made to keep us fed. There was some breakfast. Again, bread featured a lot. Sometimes we had some of the local feta cheesy kind of stuff, which was like, you know, that they could easily sort of get or bribe or, you know. I just don't remember much. There wasn't potatoes or tomatoes or anything.
Because all the farming, all the
it was
access,
all stopped.
All the transport.
Yeah. Just like now in Ukraine, when it's bombed all the time and there's a scorched earth policy, you can't actually grow. And remember, again, this was an urban center. So anyway, there wasn't much farming going on in the city of Sarajevo. And it was a terrible situation. And I remember when the siege started to be slowly lifted, one of my friends went across the lines and came back with a bag of, I think it was tomatoes. That's my memory. And it was the first fresh tomatoes we'd seen.
How long were you there for?
Years. But of course, I went in and out in a military plane, which was the only way to get out, if you could. But I did spend most of those 3 years of the 90s in Bosnia.
Wow. And when you would return on the plane from Sarajevo going to Paris, are you thinking about what you're going to eat? Are you thinking?
No, first I'm thinking of leaving those people behind and feeling very guilty.
I was going to ask you about the kindness of strangers. You know, being in these very tough situations, is the connections, are they very firmly established?
Very firmly established. Because to be frank, apart from anything else, your life depends on having good relations with your competitors and your colleagues. You know,
and the people of the city,
they were mostly grateful for us to tell their story. But, and I have to say, it is important, they did begin to get angry. I remember them saying, you know, turn your cameras away from us. This isn't the Sarajevo safari. You keep telling our stories and the world doesn't intervene, doesn't help us. And those were very painful moments because you did realize that they were telling the truth, that, yeah, we could go to them, talk to them, get their experiences, see what they were trying to cook for their families, which was pretty much nothing in their little kitchens and trying to survive this war. And nothing was happening to help them. So then they would take it out on us because we were the closest for them. Yeah, and it was painful.
Yeah.
That was painful. Yeah. So I have no illusion that we are welcomed with open arms and we're the great saviors at all. At all. We do a job. If we're lucky, we tell the truth and the truth gets out. And if we're very, very lucky, it causes intervention. So it didn't in Sarajevo until the Srebrenica massacre, which was nearly 3 years, 3 years after the war started. Of course, in Ukraine, it was totally different. And it's great that the West did intervene to help Ukraine defend itself when it was illegally occupied, invaded, and the Russians went to war against them. So the difference in the world's reaction is remarkable.
It is remarkable.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having pink lady apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Should we talk about Iran?
Yes.
What did your father and mother do?
My father was, he worked in a travel agency. Mm-hmm. And my mom was, you know, what do you call it? A homemaker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she looked after us. We're four girls. I'm the oldest of. My mother, English Catholic. My father, Iranian Muslim. So I grew up in a very mixed ethnic and, you know, household that I think served me very well in my career, because I then understood that actually you can get past identity. You can actually always find the commonality in people. And, you know, the idea of mixed ethnicities or religions or nationalities means nothing to me. It's just normal. Also, my mom was a very strong woman and really did run the household and was very influential on us and our let's say, our moral and spiritual education. Quite a strict Catholic, and was my father allowed it, never said, I'm the man and I'm Muslim and you have to bring up in Iran, you know, the kids as Muslims, none of that. He absolutely agreed to my mother's demands. But it was I just remember a very, very happy household that actually revolved around my mother's cooking.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So your mother was British?
Yes.
Did your mother bring British food?
Not really.
Tehran?
You see, I don't even think, well, yes and no. I don't know whether my mother was a particularly accomplished cook before she got married. I think she learned on the job, so to speak. And she did become excellent. And we were the only ones really that in my group of friends that were serving more sort of Western food. So my friends would come to my house for my mother's pizza, for her chocolate cake, which was, I think, kind of like a flourless chocolate cake before I even knew that that was the case, but a very rich chocolate cake that was beautifully iced and was delicious and everybody loved it. And chocolate mousse. I mean, I have such great memories of my mom making these things, and that I would be sitting at the table just trying to grab the spoon like all kids do, you know, and lick the spoon and just love it. And angel cake. So we had the chocolate cake and then the angel cake. And it just was sort of a theme of my childhood that my friends loved it and were always anxious to come to my house.
Yeah. And what about the Persian food then?
Well, the Persian food was mostly when we went out to friends' houses or to families' houses, but also on a Friday, which is sort of the Sunday in the Middle East. It's like the Sabbath, the Friday. Everybody's the holiday, the weekend. And the traditional Persian rural meal is called chelo kebab. Chelo is the rice. Chelo kebab.
Oh, okay.
Is the rice, so it's this pile of steaming white rice with saffron on the top and a crust underneath, which is very
difficult.
Yes, and it's very difficult to achieve. Yeah, it's really tough to make. I do actually.
What do they do?
Well, first of all, you have to boil the rice al dente as if you were doing pasta.
Right.
Then you take it out. You've already washed it, got rid of all the extraneous starch. So you take it out, and then you have this sort of very substantial iron pot. And you probably melt a little butter in the bottom and let that go all over the bottom. Then you take a layer of the rice and you pack it down very hard. Then you put the rest of the rice in. Remember, in Iran, you cook for lots of people. So this is a big pot.
Oh, so you put a thin layer down.
Yes, and
first,
pack it down
hard.
Which
you know will be the crust.
Yes. Okay. And then you put the other pyramid on. You put holes with the, you know, with the handle of a spoon. You pour in copious amounts of melted butter. And then you put a top covered by a dish towel. And that then steams. You put the heat on quite high for about 10 minutes to give the crispiness. Then you immediately turn it down, and the rest is about 30 to 40 minutes of steaming this rice. So you have a very light but buttery rice. Saffron then you pour on afterwards when you've dished it up. And if you've done it right and you've got the high heat, low heat, done just right, you get this wonderful crust called tadig.
And this is from a woman who says she doesn't like to cook.
I like to remember.
I'm sorry.
I like to remember and I like to eat, exactly.
Yeah, well, but can I just ask you, in that, maybe I got it wrong, but the rice was cooked before you pressed it down.
Al dente.
And then you've cooked
al dente.
It for another 30
you've
minutes.
You steamed so it for another.
Okay.
So it's still very fluffy. You don't overcook it.
Like, okay. Because I was wondering about cooking and then cooking for another 40 minutes.
That's why you have to make it al dente. It's not like you put a bunch of rice on this and then let all the water absorb.
No, okay.
And it's really delicious. And then the thing that went with it is the kebab, the meat. So it's either boneless chicken or chicken on the bone, or it's minced lamb with other stuff that you put in it. Don't ask me because I haven't done it.
Yeah.
Or
or
it's more of a filet steak, like the filet, very tender, and that you put
I like it all.
I don't, not so keen on the mince. I find that somewhat sometimes a little indigestible. But you know, before the age of salmonella and all the rest of it, instead of when you served the rice, you would get a raw egg, crack the egg, separate the white from the yolk, and then you put the yolk in the rice and mix that up instead of butter, because you've already got a lot of butter.
If you heat it up. Yeah. But going back to Tehran, your father was Persian.
Yeah.
And did you have grandparents?
Yes. You see, my father was 19 years older than my mother, and he was the youngest of five boys. So just imagine how old my grandmother was.
Right.
Very, very old. And all I remember was this very old lady who was quite terrifying, quite strict. But we did visit her on Fridays, I remember. Again, that's the holiday. And all I remember is that we would come in, she would be sat at the end of the room in what looked like an armchair throne. And then all of us would be arranged, you know, around the sides of the room. And in front of us were these little tiny side tables on which were very carefully peeled oranges, I remember. And so we'd eat the oranges and have some pistachio nuts. And it was quite formal. We'd have to go and kiss each cheek. And then, honestly, we couldn't wait to leave. Yeah. But I'm sure she was fabulous. And to be frank, I wish I'd known more about my grandparents.
Maybe she was tired.
For sure. I mean, the mother...
I think I'm going to try, you know, giving my children pistachio nuts.
It's an interesting history.
You know, you remember her. I definitely remember her. You know, being 90. Yeah. You know,
my father's father had died, so I never met him, and my father barely knew him. One thing I do remember about tomatoes, though, my dad said that when he was the youngest of these five strapping boys, they used to bully him and jump on top of him and, get this, stuff his mouth with tomatoes, which he hated.
That's funny.
I remember that story. Yeah.
And he didn't cook at all.
No, but he did do a mean vinaigrette. Oh. And to this day, that's my vinaigrette.
What
and I
it?
Teach it to whoever comes
Tell
in
me.
My... Should
okay,
I?
Somebody who doesn't
I'm not
cook
going to tell
is giving
you.
Me yet another
no,
recipe.
I'm not going to
oh,
tell you.
Oh, you
no.
don't want to tell the world?
No.
Oh, why?
It's because it's secret.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, there are some people, they're
it's
restaurants
the only thing I know.
Sometimes they always say that restaurants will, you know, give a recipe and then leave something out or, you know.
But then it would be no good if I gave it and then left something out.
No, you wouldn't do that.
No, it's the only thing I know. It's the only secret I have.
Because a good vinaigrette is hard to make.
It is.
You know.
And my dad, I always remember my dad. You know, he died in 2016. And I always remember that.
You remember his vinaigrette.
I have the vinaigrette. And
have you taught it to Darius?
Yes.
Okay.
And to whoever comes into my orbit and... you know, needs to make some vinaigrette.
Yeah. But do you remember going to markets in Tehran? Were there beautiful
markets? Oh, well, actually, no, I did. They're called bazaars, obviously. It's not like the French or Italian or British markets, but bazaars, which were, I guess, almost even more magnificent because, I mean, if anybody's been to the Great Bazaar in Istanbul, imagine that in all the other Middle Eastern countries. And we used to go. I do remember my mother would do the shopping, obviously. I would just be amazed by the color and the vibrancy and the, I want this and I want that, even if I didn't know what it was. I'm afraid that the men at that time were very cheeky and quite intrusive. So I used to go not knowing any better in my shorts or my short skirt or whatever and get my bum pinched. That was quite de rigueur in those days. My mum told me from now on I had to bring a flip-flop, you know, sandal, hold it behind my bum, and if anybody dared, boom, you know, bang them. It really worked.
Yeah, When I went to Syria with Richard, we went to Damascus, and we went to the bazaar. Again, the food was very different from a market you would see in France or Italy. And it was even more compelling because there was the sanctions. There was no Coca-Cola sign. Yeah. There was not, you know, any hamburgers or anything Western at all. And was growing up in the Shah's reign, was that more American? Was it because there was a good relationship between?
Yeah, I mean,
It
was more friendly to the West, for sure. But remember, it was only a minority of people who were able to benefit from that. Although he did bring in, you know, education, rights for women, all of that. But in the end, you know, there was this religious revolution in 1979, theocracy. And to be honest, weirdly, the Iranian revolution propelled me into my career because that's when I realized, A, I needed to make it on my own. I could not rely on my lovely parents and my idyllic childhood and whatever they thought I might do with the rest of my life. And I needed to make my way in the world.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
The Iranian Revolution was a first-hand experienced historical earthquake that clearly still has reverberations to this day. And I realized that I actually want to tell those kind of stories.
Yeah. So you were actually there when Khomeini...
My father sent me out about 2 weeks, if I remember, before came back. Yeah, he came back around the 1st of February.
Yeah.
And I was sent out in the middle of January 1979. And I'm
to
glad...
Where?
Well, first to England, where my English grandmother was, and then on to America to go to university. I decided that's where I needed to make my way in the world, to go to university, be a journalist.
Did you have experience of the United States and Britain? It wasn't like being lifted from Iran.
With the United States. I'd visited once as a teenager, but that's it. But I obviously, you know, every summer I would go and stay with my mother's family. Mm. We would all go to England for the summer holidays.
And you didn't have pistachio nuts?
We didn't. My grandmother was a very simple cook, but great. You know, creme caramel,
nice.
Roast pork and crackling. Mm. Those were the things. Fish fingers.
And when you were living with your grandmother alone, your parents were still in Tehran?
Yeah, I didn't really live with her really much. I mean, we were in boarding school for a period of time during the 70s, my sister and I. And we went, you know, for half terms and weekends because the parents were living in Iran. That's where our home was. But we'd go back for the major holidays.
And then you were on your own. So tell the story of what happened and when you went to the United States.
So, you know, U.S., kind of easy. My first year was, you know, refectory food or whatever you call it, canteen food.
But
disgusting.
Where? Okay, tell me about that.
University in the U.S., you know, my first year, I was at the University of Rhode Island, which I loved. It was in Kingston, Rhode Island. After about a year, I then lived off campus with friends, and that's where I first learned to cook.
Okay, that's...
In fact, I have brought a little prop.
Oh, because
this, for me, is a comfort blanket. It's a tiny, slim tome. It's called Inner Persian Kitchen. It's got a illustration of a Persian dancer and a woman holding a basket of fruit. And it's very, very well thumbed and dirty, as you can see.
Yeah.
It's had a lot of, you know, stuff. I set up a rota. So we were five. We each had a day of the week where we'd go to the supermarket and shop for the week. Each week, one different person did it, and each night of the week, a different person would cook. And that was fab. And so I would cook out of this Persian cookbook, and it was great. And that's where I first learned about tofu. One of my roommates was a vegetarian. Another one did trout. Another one did hamburgers or steak. It was really amazing. But what was really great was that we ate well every night at home, and we would invite friends. It became like the River Cafe. Yeah. A hot ticket, Ruth. People wanted to come to our table.
Were you the only non-American in that group?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you cook Persian?
Yes, I did. And if I could get the tadig right, the crust, I was in, you know, very popular that night. If not, there were some complaints. But it was cool because, you know, it was the 80s. We talked about the campaign for nuclear disarmament, anti-apartheid. And to this day, I have family lunches and group dinners. And
You usually go Sundays.
Sundays.
I often ask you if you want to do something on a Sunday. You're with your family, aren't you?
Yeah.
Now, what about cooking for your son?
Well, I mean, my son, to be frank, is a better cook than I am. And I'm so grateful that he's a great cook and he likes it.
Yeah, yeah.
He likes it.
Good.
He loves it. I did do stuff, but I'm not brilliant. His dad taught him how to do pancakes and things like that. Mm. It's a very good breakfast cook. There is his dad. But, you know, I did some stuff. I can do a roast chicken, Ruthie.
The Global Central Kitchen in Ukraine. Did you get involved in that? Did you
Chef Jose Andres, who is an amazing man,
Let's talk about him.
Yeah, and he's got this amazing operation called World Central Kitchen, which he takes, I think, if I'm not mistaken, he first started in Puerto Rico, Hurricane Maria.
Yeah.
And what he did was quite simple. It's not, again, it's not like just handouts. He comes, he scopes the situation, he looks at all the local restaurants or bars or whatever, and mobilizes them to be able to cook and helps them if he has to bring in supplies and things like that to feed their communities. So it starts small-ish in terms of how many meals per day they're able to deliver, and then it gathers momentum. And they have a very, very good social media platform now, and they've got a lot of help. But what they do is quite revolutionary, because in wartime or in crisis, they do what others can't do, and it has a huge impact.
And they worked with other restaurants.
That's right.
I didn't understand
that.
Yes,
they worked with
restaurants. And carrying boxes from restaurants to feed people.
Yep.
You know, just
they went
crossing
to train
bridges.
Stations, to hospitals, to refugee centers, to places like that. And they even had to, you know, try to get the train lines, the railway lines, to help move things from one city to another. It was quite an operation. I mean, it's really something.
He's phenomenal, I think.
Yeah, a logistical...
And what was it like for you being there? Was it very different from Sarajevo? Was there...
It was somewhat different, but it was... I was there during a turning point, which was really interesting, and that's when the Ukrainians pushed the Russians back from Kyiv. So I was in Kyiv at that period, and I could see with my own eyes, you know, how the momentum on the ground was shifting and how the incredible support of NATO, led by the United States and many other European countries and their neighboring countries, was really making a difference. And,
Well, is there Ukraine food identity?
There is. I don't want to over-talk it because I didn't get to experience much of that in restaurants. But, you know, soups, what they call dumplings.
Borscht?
Obviously, their version of borscht, which they very clear is not like
it's
the Russian,
not Russian borscht.
A lot of meat, a lot of potatoes. As you know, Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. So it's going to be very difficult. And Africa. And even Russia is the fertilizer central for the world. So this war is going to, and people are very concerned, and international leaders are very concerned, that it will not only exacerbate, you know, food poverty around the world, it could lead to famines. And depending on how long it goes on, it could lead to unrest. Remember, the Arab Spring started in Tunisia because of the high price of food and food poverty.
So we're looking at a real crisis.
It's a huge crisis. And Putin has shown the world that when they try to react just gently, like they did in 2014, he just rolls right over the rest of the world.
Have you ever interviewed him?
No, I'd like to.
Wouldn't you?
Interviewed Zelensky just before the invasion.
Did you? What was
it was
like?
Just amazing.
What was he like?
He was incredible, really incredible. And he came with a warning to the West. It was in Munich, what's called the Munich Security Conference.
Yeah.
It was 19th. The invasion was on the 24th. He actually came out of his country. And you'll like this because it's about food. I said to him, Mr. President, most people here didn't expect you to be here. You've got the threat of an invasion. The United States, your biggest backers, have suggested you don't leave at this precise moment. And he said, I had breakfast in Kyiv. I'm having lunch in Munich to tell you our story and what we need. And I'm going to have dinner in Kyiv tonight.
Is there any city that really means something to you for food. I mean, that you think, I'm going to the city, I know where I want to eat, I know what I want to eat, I know...
Paris.
Yeah.
Ile de Ré, which is not a city, has lovely, lovely restaurants, very simple, really also delicious. London, yeah. New York. I mean, yeah. to be honest so with you, I am very ecumenical about all of that because there are great restaurants all over the world and in the most unlikely places. One of the great things that Anthony Bourdain did for the world, God rest his soul, was show the world that in the most unlikely corners, in the most unlikely places, as well as in the obvious places, the idea of food was always there, and the greatest food and the greatest experience and atmospheres. And I think actually what you're doing and what he did, there's no doubt that you bring people together over food in every single way, whether in joy, in grief, in friendship, in family, whatever it is.
And comfort.
And comfort.
So that's my last question to you, is if you need comfort, whether you're, well, probably when you're in a place where you can get the food of your choice, is there a food that you would turn to? I think I might know the answer.
Yes, you probably do know the answer. You know, it really is Persian food, and it's the white rice, usually the boneless chicken that goes with it, and a grilled tomato that comes with it as well. And if I'm feeling okay, I'll crack that egg yolk in it.
Yeah.
And that will be, it'll be rich, but it'll also be very, very comforting.
Be careful in Afghanistan.
I will. The women there who've been so terribly, terribly marginalized again after 20 years of promise and activity and showing how phenomenal they are, they've been so marginalized. And by the way, the dramatic food poverty in Afghanistan right now because of the sanctions that have been put on the Taliban. It's a tragedy, an absolute tragedy.
Come back.
I will.
Thank you, Christian.
Thank you, Ruth.
River Cafe Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid Kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.